KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Stephen Hill, political writer and director of the Political Reform Program for the New America Foundation. Stephen's previous books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His articles and commentaries have appeared in many newspapers and magazines, including The New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, and Salon.com. Stephen Hill is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age, published in 2010 by the University of California Press. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. What led you to write your book, Europe's Promise?
I direct a political reform program, and so that's really my area of focus. And in the late 1990s, I began traveling to Europe to study their political systems and institutions and their democracy. And that's when I began to notice, you know, it's not just their political institutions where they're using things like proportional representation, public financing of campaigns, universal voter registration, free media time for candidates. That's all different than what we have here. But in fact, a lot more is different. Their healthcare systems are different. Their energy and transportation systems are different. Even the way they structure corporations are quite different than here. And I think it's fair to say when I began traveling to Europe, I had a lot of the same ideas about Europe that I think most Americans have. And in the process of traveling back and forth for about 10 years off and on, I started realizing that a lot of what Americans believe about Europe is not true. There's a lot of myths and stereotypes about it, and it really prevents us from not only understanding Europe, but from understanding our own country.
How would you evaluate the current health and success of Europe overall?
Well, when you look at various health and social indicators, you see that Europe is generally far ahead of the United States in terms of things like poverty, for example. The United States has 14% of Americans living in poverty. That's about 40 million people compared to a place like France with only 6% or Germany with 5%. We have 20% of children in poverty, 23% of seniors. It's the highest figure by far in the Western world, except for Russia and Mexico. And we have in the United States, 10% of the population owns 70% of the wealth compared to a country like Germany, where 10% owns 44% of the wealth. So there's a lot of different ways you can count these things. But in those sorts of ways, in healthcare, there's all sorts of tests that are done and comparisons. And Americans, we're spending about 17% of our gross domestic product of our economy on healthcare. And when you look at the healthcare indicators, we're getting worse health than in France and Germany and Britain and other places, even though they're spending 8, 9, you know, in case of France, which has the highest rated healthcare system in the world, about 11% of GDP on healthcare. So we're spending more money, in other words, for worse outcomes.
How would you characterize the goals of government in Europe compared to the United States?
The goals of government are more about, you know, both the United States and Europe have very strong, robust economies, though we've had a world economic meltdown. But nevertheless, our economies all produce a lot of wealth. But there's a question there, who gets that wealth? Whose pockets does that wealth go into? And that's where the goals of government and of people in general and, you know, all political parties, really, even the conservative parties in Europe, the goals there are how to harness that wealth in a way that creates a more broadly shared prosperity. So you see that over and over again, where even conservative politicians in Germany, so for example, Chancellor Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, she'll talk about the need to preserve what they call social Europe. And by that, they mean the support that families and individuals have in this increasingly economic insecure age. They give these supports to families and individuals. And those supports look like healthcare, pensions, you know, paid sick leave, paid parental leave, low cost, and in some countries still free university education, more job retraining, all these sorts of things they consider to be the supports that families and individuals need in order to remain healthy and productive. And that's really the goal of their societies. And this is what I call in my book social capitalism compared to what we have in the United States, which I call Wall Street capitalism.
How does life for the average citizen compare in the U.S. to Europe? You've been alluding to this, but perhaps you could particularly focus on the aspect of security.
Sure. When it comes to economic security, the average European is going to have a lot more support for the different things they need in their lives. So if they need childcare, you know, in the United States, an average family with two children is paying about at least $12,000 a year in childcare. In a place like France, you're paying maybe $2,000, $2,500 a year. And when you bring your child to childcare, lunch is provided for them. And the childcare workers are all professionally trained. The whole system is very professional compared to the U.S., where it's all very ad hoc and the quality can really vary widely. So, you know, when it comes to healthcare, for example, if you go to a place like France, they actually have private insurance companies like we have in the United States. But the key difference is that those private insurance companies are nonprofits. Here, they're for-profits. And the incentive of a for-profit company, even when it's healthcare, is to jack up your premiums as high as they can. Hence, Anthem Blue Cross recently just announced that the premiums of some of their customers are going to go up by 40%. And their other incentive is to give you as few services as possible, because every time they give you a service, that's money out of their pockets. That's the incentives of our for-profit system. But in Germany, as an example, they have nonprofit insurance companies. Their incentives are to provide health care for people. So the experience of people is not being treated as a number. They don't have things like pre-existing conditions where you have to basically, you know, not tell your doctor things about your personal history, medically speaking, because they may deny your coverage. So it's just a much different experience in that way.
And how has society been able to get the funding to cover all of these social programs?
Well, they get their funding through a few ways. One, they have economic democracy to a greater extent than we have here. So they have in their economy, using Germany as a good example, they have something called co-determination, where the largest corporations in Germany, so corporations like Siemens, BMW, Daimler, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Deutsche Telekom, all of them, they have a board of directors like we have here for our corporations. But 50% of the board members are elected by the workers. It would be as if, imagine if there was a law in the United States requiring Walmart to allow its workers to elect 50% of its board members. You can imagine how that would change Walmart's behavior towards its workers as well as in other ways as well. This is standard practice in Germany, Sweden, and other places. A lot of Americans don't know about co-determination, but by having this sort of thing in your economy, and it's what, broadly speaking, is called in Europe consultation. You hear that word a lot, consultation. It allows everyday people to have more input into their workplaces, into these institutions that affect our lives so much in a way that Americans can scarcely imagine. So these are the sorts of things that really make a big difference in people's lives.
In your book, you observe the ability of Europe to have a good standard of living for a smaller ecological footprint than the U.S. What do you see as the underlying reason for this?
The underlying reason is that Europe takes more seriously the challenge of global warming, global climate change. You know, you don't have the naysayers in Europe like you have here in the United States. And so they've begun putting real money towards these efforts, and not just money, but government policy. So, for example, some of the countries in Europe, if you're a supplier of energy and you produce it through either solar or wind power or sea power, Europe is doing some amazing things with using the sea, harnessing the sea for power. You receive more money per kilowatt hour than just the normal carbon-fueled sort of ways of producing power. And that has allowed an industry to grow. Because a lot of industries like this need a bit of subsidy at the beginning in order to allow them to reach economies of scale where then they can operate on their own. And by growing this industry, they've created hundreds of thousands of jobs in the green industries in Portugal and Spain and Germany and elsewhere. And that, in return, has helped Europeans to reduce their electricity use, to reduce their carbon emissions. The average European uses about half the carbon of an average American. It takes 40% more fuel to go a mile in an American car than it takes in a European car. There's all sorts of different ways, the way they've designed buildings now to lower carbon emissions and electricity use in buildings. And one of my favorite examples is in Germany, they have these buildings where they dig these shafts down into the ground until you reach a point where the air temperature is the same regardless of the time of year. And then you can pull that air up and you can heat it or cool it depending on what you need to do, what time of year it is, with very little energy put into it to do that. They also are doing things like hermetically sealed buildings where very little air gets in or out. And so as you want to bring in fresh air, it can exchange the heat with the air that's inside the building in a way that you lose very little heat in the process. And so by doing these sorts of things, Europe is really taking the idea of green design to a whole level way beyond the LEED volunteer guidelines that some builders use in the United States.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Stephen Hill, author of the book Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How does the health of the economy in Europe compare with the health of the economy in the United States?
Well, both economies are having a hard time right now because of the economic collapse that was precipitated predominantly by Wall Street and their use of these exotic investment vehicles, derivatives and credit default swaps and what have you. And so the world experienced this economic earthquake over a year ago of about 8.0 on the Richter scale, and we're seeing a lot of aftershocks since then. In California, where I live, we've had, you know, a horrible time lately. In fact, I just saw a report just in yesterday's newspaper from the Los Angeles Times saying that 25% of Californians now do not have health care. Millions didn't have health care before the crisis, and now a lot of them have lost their jobs and lost their health care as a result. So, you know, things aren't going well in the United States, California, and other places as a result of this crisis. And Europe is also having a difficult time, but they've adopted different policies that have led to different results in certain ways. So, again, using Germany as an example, which has done some really good things during this economic crisis, rather than laying off millions of workers like we've done in the United States, our unemployment rate has more than doubled during this economic crisis. In Germany, what they've done is they had all workers take a little bit of time off. So they spread the pain around. So if you were working 100%, now maybe you're working 90% or 80% of full time. But during the good years, Germany squirreled away some money so that if you were working 100% and now you're working 80%, you're still getting 90% of your pay. And what this does is, besides not more people are laid off, it means that more people have money in their pockets. Because what happens in an economic crisis like this is that businesses start laying off people. People have less money, they stop spending, so then businesses have fewer customers, they have to lay off more people. You get in this downward cycle. Well, by doing this short work, as it's called, or Kurzarbeit is what they call it in Germany, you intervene on this downward cycle. It also means you keep your workforce intact so that when the recovery begins, you're ready to go. And the other thing it does is it doesn't devastate communities like happens with layoffs. In California, I'm from the Bay Area. And communities like Stockton, 40% of houses are in foreclosure. You have entire neighborhoods that are boarded up. Weeds are growing up. Unsavory elements have moved into the boarded up homes. And then the human cost of people losing their jobs, breadwinners losing their jobs, increase in alcoholism, mental health issues, all the sorts of things that happen with layoffs. Well, Germany has avoided this in many ways by using this short work. And when Robert Rubin, who's been one of President Obama's main advisors, was asked about this German policy, and why don't we do that here in the United States? His response was, that's not American. In America, we're about creating new jobs, not about preserving old ones, as if there's a conflict between the two. So in some ways, Europe has been more pragmatic about these things, and the United States seems to be really stuck to this fundamentalist view of ourselves as a free market economy.
Are there additional ways that Europe protects and encourages workers?
Yes, there are. In Europe, you have other things like consultation, co-determination, works councils. Works councils are quite interesting. At every job site, the workers elect a council, and that council then is able to have a great deal of negotiating power with the employer about things like layoffs and structuring the workday, flexibility on the work site, whether you can take time off to be with your children and these sorts of things. You know, and again, these are the sorts of things that are being used throughout Europe. They've done studies about what employers think of things like co-determination, where, you know, workers are electing the boards of directors of 50% of the board members in Germany and a third in Sweden. And employers say, you know, it's kind of a pain, but it actually helps us. It helps us to facilitate communication with our employees and our workers. And it helps us to keep sort of peace in the family, in the business, in a way that allows them to keep building on the productivity of their workers and not have the disruptions that you have when labor tensions are higher with the employer.
How robust is democracy in Europe compared to the United States in terms of expressing the will of the people?
Well, I think that Europe has many different institutions than we have. You just look at what's happening in the United States right now, where you have, I think, a lot of the things that President Obama said he wanted to do on the campaign trail and I think wants to do. He was blindsided by needing 60 votes in the Senate to get anything done. And, you know, as I've been calling it, the filibuster gone wild Senate. no European country do you need 60 out of 100 votes to get something done, 60%, in other words, a supermajority. Also, we've seen in the United States recently the Supreme Court with a new rulings that's basically turned on the spigot for corporate donations. In Europe, for the most part, corporations are not allowed to donate to campaigns. Instead, they have full public financing of campaigns. They have free media time for candidates. They have proportional representation that elects a multi-party democracy, so voters have more choice. You see more women getting elected, more young people, 19-year-olds getting elected to the parliaments in Germany and Sweden and Denmark and elsewhere. And so this allows people to see themselves reflected in their legislatures to a degree that many Americans don't experience today. Then in return, leads to better policy in terms of putting in place this kind of social capitalism, putting supports around families and workers, coming up with policies that allow Europe to reduce its environmental impact much more than we can in the United States by implementing these conservation and renewable technologies.
Would you like to touch briefly on the difference between Europe and the U.S. of the media industry?
Yes. Well, in Europe, what you see is a much more robust public broadcasting sector. For example, the BBC is receiving funding on a level of $60 per capita for public broadcasting. I mean, there's several stations that they have with a whole range of programming, both educational, news, as well as entertainment. And then compared to public broadcasting in the United States, which receives about $3 per capita in terms of funding. And so there's much more funding for public broadcasting, but then the mechanism is different. Instead of it being allocated by Congress, as it is in the United States every year, where especially when Republicans were in control of Congress and were hostile to the mission of public broadcasting, then public broadcasting was always in this position of having to tap dance to those who pay the bills, so to speak. But in Britain, Germany, France, and other places, what they do instead is that every household pays about $15, kind of like how Americans pay for cable TV. You pay that amount towards the public broadcasting system. And by doing it that way, it allows the public broadcasting sector to have more independent journalism. Anybody who's heard a BBC interview with their politicians, they're rather direct and even hard-hitting in certain ways compared to, I sometimes find, national public radio's interviews with elected officials to be kind of puffball. They really don't, you know, go right after it and ask them really hard questions. And so it's certainly not like what types of interviews that you all do here at KEXP. So, you know, I think that it's both the amount of money that's available as well as the funding mechanism that allows for that independent journalism. Then also more widespread implementation of the internet. The U.S. used to lead in terms of access to the internet, and now we've fallen quite behind. We're behind, even Estonia in Europe on this. And Europe has moved forward aggressively in a way to make both internet more widely available, less expensive, but also with faster connection times. So people are designing these jazzy websites with much faster connection times than what many Americans have. So those sorts of ways. They also have a more robust newspaper sector. You know, in the United States, newspapers are in the process of, and many of them, of having really a hard time, if not outright dying. So here in Seattle, the PI went out of business in terms of daily newspapers, and they're just a website now. Well, in Europe, newspapers are still pretty much flourishing. And part of that is because the government, certain countries subsidize newspapers. At the very least, they give them less expensive mailing and sales tax. They don't charge sales tax for things like newspapers. But some of them, and particularly the Scandinavian countries, they outright give subsidies to some of the newspapers because they recognize that it's important that people read about the news. There's a lot of studies showing that people who read about the news retain more information than, say, television. And in addition, that it promotes what's called civic literacy. People not only can read, but they're well-versed on the issues that affect them and have a position on those issues in a way that they know their own interest and what to support, what politicians to support, depending on what they're pushing. So newspapers actually play a fairly crucial role in the civic literacy of a society. And in Europe, they're still doing quite well. And here in the United States, they're actually in serious trouble. And the newspapers in the United States is really the only sector that's not subsidized to some degree. TV, the corporate broadcasters, receive a huge federal subsidy, $300-400 billion per year in terms of giving away that bandwidth for free. And newspapers don't get anything like that. And that, I think that's something that's showing as a result.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Stephen Hill, author of the book Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. In your book, you observe that in the U.S., we tend to not notice or be aware of the European way. Why do you think this is the case?
Americans are used to thinking that we're the best and to thinking that what we do, therefore, must be the best, even though, you know, the American way, which I've been calling Wall Street capitalism, of basically deregulation, government is the problem, as Ronald Reagan said in his first inaugural address. We've seen ever since then 40 years of Republican bashing of government and trumpeting business as the solution. Well, that philosophy just crashed around us. We reached a point where government had to bail out the big banks. Our free market system reached a point where we privatized the gains and socialized the losses. That's our free market system, so-called. And so Europeans look at this. They don't understand why Americans are so fundamentalist in how we approach these things. They don't understand why we have 47 million people without health care. They don't understand why we would be so reluctant to re-regulate the financial industry. And it was a year ago that Europe, at the G20 meeting, pushed for financial re-regulation of regulating hedge funds and credit default swaps and these other investment vehicles. And Timothy Geithner, Secretary of Treasury, started foot-dragging. Well, now Europe is saying, we're going forward without you. We're going to regulate these things whether you want to do it or not, because they recognize that free markets are good. Capitalism creates wealth. That's obvious. But it's also true that left to its own devices, it creates a lot of problems. And so really, it's a matter of striking a balance between the right degree of regulation that allows that wealth that's created to be broadly shared among a lot of people, but not so much regulation that you strangle off your entrepreneurship. That's really the challenge, that the balance that has to be struck. And I think Europe has struck that in a way that's much healthier and has produced much better results than what we have in the United States.
What do you see as the challenges to the European way or the potential weaknesses?
The challenges are, first, this economic crisis, which everyone is facing, you know, how to sort of get the global economy moving again. And there are signs that things are starting to move. And in that process, there have been some cutbacks in some countries. Greece, for example, has had a difficult time, sort of like California has had a difficult time. And so now some people, their hours are going to be cut. Some of their social support systems that Greek people have relied upon is, you know, they're going to have to figure out how to use things more efficiently. But even so, I mean, during this economic crisis in Greece, all the people in Greece still have health care. They still have access to this support system compared to a place like California, where, as I mentioned earlier, 25% of the population do not have health care. They don't have access to any of the supports that people in Greece are having during this difficult time. So that's certainly going to be a challenge. Some of the other challenges have to do with immigration. And, you know, there's been a lot of in the news sort of headlines about immigration. And what I concluded in looking at that is that Europe doesn't have an immigration problem. It has an integration problem, because Europe actually needs a certain degree of immigration. But they've been at this game of integration for a lot less time than we have in the United States. And so at first they had to recognize that they have a problem. They've reached that point. And now they've begun to spend billions of euros in fostering that kind of integration, including spending money on bilingual classes, money on radio programs in different languages, in Kurdish language and languages from North Africa, producing these soap operas in which you have kind of like the multiracial Brady Bunch, if you will, all living together. And, you know, they're quite popular, these shows, in which the issues and the tensions that are real in society are dealt with in the soap operas. Some countries, like, for example, Austria, have just passed its first anti-discrimination laws. And so it's hard to predict where this is going to go, but my sense is that Europe is really starting to grapple with this problem in a way that they weren't previously, and that we will see how it works out. But I think on the whole, I came away feeling fairly positive that they are dealing with these issues.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I hope that Europe's Promise, and there's a website for the book that people might want to check out more. It's just www.europespromise.org. I hope that at the very least it'll open up Americans to seeing that there are other ways of doing things, and that we can learn from a place like Europe, and that a lot of what we've heard about Europe is really myths and stereotypes. And one real quick myth that Americans hear a lot is that Europeans pay more in taxes than we Americans pay. And that's actually a distortion of the reality. Because if you're an American that's paying much higher healthcare premiums, you know, as I said, Anthem Blue Cross jacking up their premiums by up to 40%. If you're an American paying for childcare, if you're paying for university education, if you're paying for your senior parents who need to be taken care of, Americans pay a lot more out of pocket for these sorts of things that Europeans get in exchange for their taxes. So when you start balancing up who's paying more for what they get, you have to include what Americans pay out of pocket to get these things. And yet when you look at things like Forbes Tax Misery Index, all they look at is things like income tax and maybe sales tax and maybe a few other minor taxes. That's all they're looking at. And so European countries are up there among the most tax miserable, high on the list. And there's the U.S. down there happy as a clam around Indonesia and Malaysia. Well, it's just a complete distortion of the reality because Americans are paying a lot more out of pocket for health care, child care. You know, 60 million American workers don't have paid sick leave. So they have to either self-subsidize their own paid sick leave or show up to work sick and infect all their coworkers. Europeans are getting paid sick leave and more. So, you know, these are the sorts of myths that not only prevent us from understanding what's happening in Europe, but it prevents us from understanding what's happening in our own country. Because if we think that somehow, well, Europe has all these things, that's great, but at least we're not paying high in taxes, and we don't recognize, yeah, but you're still paying out a ton of money out of pocket for the same things they're getting in exchange for those taxes, then it scares Americans off from really trying the types of things that they're doing in Europe that have been so successful.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Let's not be stuck to the flypaper of old ideas. Let's not, you know, assume that the mainstream media is really getting it right. I mean, the mainstream media, we know they missed it on weapons of mass destruction. They completely missed it on an $8 trillion housing bubble. Oops, missed that one too. Well, they've been, in the same way, they've been missing it with Europe. I mean, one of my best examples is that in October 2006, there was an article in Newsweek International with a big headline saying Europe, the great job machine, talking about how it was producing more jobs and more economic growth than we were in the United States. And in the domestic version of Newsweek, that article never appeared. Instead, you saw all sorts of headlines about Europe's dying, Europe is dying out, Europe is a mess, Europe's never going to work. And we're seeing that now around the Greek crisis. There are certainly issues there around the Greek debt issue, but it's not nearly as it's being portrayed in the media. I think it's good that people in Greece are out in the streets. Why aren't people in the United States out in the streets upset at what's going on in our country? So I hope that your listeners and people who might read the book would come away with a sense that we can learn from other places. What we're doing in the United States is not necessarily the best. And actually what's going on in Europe is quite positive and in many ways exciting. I came away excited to see there's a place where these things are working. And I call it in my book, The European Way. I mean, really, it's a story of how Europe has transformed itself from these military warring nations that they were for centuries into a model for how a modern society can develop itself, take care of its people, foster these peace and prosperity partnerships, and do that all in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as possible. I think that's exciting.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Diane. My pleasure.
You have just been listening to Stephen Hill, author of the book Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age, published in 2010 by the University of California Press. For more information, check on the web at www.europespromise.org. Again, that's europespromise.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.